keep them regular.
All right, fabulous. Wonderful to see everybody. Tonight we are getting ready for Purim. Purim is, God willing, this Monday evening, where we have the mitzvah to hear the Megillah on Monday evening, and then again.
There's the whole Megillah.
That's it, the whole Megillah. You got to hear it again on Tuesday, together with three other mitzvahs. There are a grand total of four mitzvahs associated with the holiday of Purim. One, hearing the Megillah. Number two, having a festive meal. Number three, delivering mishloach manot. That's the beautiful food packages to our friends, neighbors, and maybe people who are not our friends and neighbors. Good idea. And fourth is what's called matanot le'evyonim, is giving an extra measure of charity so that those who are in need have the money to have a Purim meal. Those are the four mitzvos. All four are done on Tuesday, the day of Purim, but we also do the Megillah the night before Monday evening, so we really hear the Megillah twice. If you're as fortunate as I am, that sometimes you get people who call you or knock on your door and say, I'm so sorry, I missed the Megillah reading. Would you mind doing it again? I'm sure, no problem. It's one thing, it happens once, maybe twice, but sometimes it happens three or four times in a day. And I'm like, yep, maybe I can skip next year since I did it numerous times this year. Can it carry over on to next year? Can I bank it for next year? The answer is no. Yes, Liz.
Just record it and play it back.
Right.
Isn't Monday night already Tuesday?
Yes, but you're right, but there's a mitzvah to hear it at night and by day.
Okay. So,
yes, technically from a Jewish standpoint, it's the same day of Purim, the 14th of Adar. However, fact being, that there's a mitzvah to hear it on the 24-hour period, what we call Tuesday. You have to hear it the night of Tuesday, i.e. Monday night, and again sometime Tuesday. Robin?
And the festive meal would be Tuesday night?
Tuesday, yep. Before sunset.
The Tuesday before sunset, okay.
Correct. At least start it before sunset. It can go the night, but at least have your meal to start the meal sometime before sundown Tuesday. Sharon?
What's the exact significance of Shushan Purim?
Okay, hold on to that one.
All right.
The long answer is that the city of Shushan, which was the capital in King Ahasuerus's empire, they celebrated, so to say, Purim the next day. They got an extra day to exact revenge against their enemies. So when the sages declared what the holiday should look like, they said any city that is like Shushan, meaning it's a walled city from the time of way back when, those read it on the 15th of Adar. Everybody else reads it the day before on the 14th of Adar. So the significance of Shushan Purim, as the name implies, is the Purim that was celebrated for the city of Shushan, which, by the way, in today's day and age, please name the city that corresponds to that, which is the city that nowadays reads it like it used to be in Shushan. That was a question.
Jerusalem?
Jerusalem is correct. That's correct. Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. So if you are in Israel at the time of Purim, you actually have 2 days to party. This is for you, Corbies, right? This is, you have 2 days to party. If you go outside of Yerushalayim, you celebrate Purim on the 14th, which is what we outside of Jerusalem, we live outside Jerusalem, everybody in this call, right? So we celebrate it on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, Tuesday night / Wednesday, they're celebrating the exact same thing in Jerusalem on Tuesday night, Wednesday. So if you're really a party animal, you go outside Jerusalem Tuesday and come into Jerusalem Wednesday. And as long as you're not driving, you can just keep drinking. So it all works.
The mitzvahs don't count on Shushan. Like if you give shalach manos on Shushan.
No.
Okay,
no.
Right.
The mitzvah for us is on the day we celebrate Purim, which for us is the 14th, which is for us Tuesday. The giving of the extra charity, the and the packages, hearing the Megillah, and the meal are all Tuesday. Anything else?
Does that mean in Yerushalayim it's 2 days? It's Tuesday and Wednesday?
No, no.
Or it's just Wednesday?
They don't do it Tuesday. They only do it Wednesday.
Okay.
Tuesday night, Wednesday.
Right. Correct.
It's very cool if you end up going to Israel for Purim, and it ends up being that Purim is on a Thursday or Friday, right? For us this year, it's Tuesday/Wednesday. For us, Tuesday, Jerusalem, Wednesday. But some calendar years, it falls out that for us, it's Thursday. For Jerusalem, it's Friday. Then we call it a three-day Purim because it goes from Shushan Purim, Friday, right into Shabbos. And you just keep it flowing, baby. That's it. It's called a three-day Purim. Yeah. Next time that is, that maybe we'll do a Shoresh trip. Okay. What, Fred?
Where? I mean, I probably remember being told years ago, but where was Shushan on a map of today? Where are we talking geographically?
Iran, Iraq, probably closer to Iran. Iran. Yeah, the Iran, Iraq area. It's Persia. That's where it is.
Okay.
Liz.
The fast isn't a mitzvah?
Nope. We do it the day before. That's on Monday. That's called the Fast of Esther. According to many, that's commemorating the fast that she encouraged the Jewish people to do in the story of Purim, so that we can beseech God to help us out of our very dire situation. So hence it gets the name. You can't fast on Purim itself because it's a holiday. Same way we don't generally fast on Shabbos or Yom Tov.
She fasted for 3 days.
That is correct. Sharon, if you'd like to, you're welcome to start early. And you can do 3 days. But the rest of us are going to be satisfied with just from sun up to sundown. That's it. That's as far as I'm doing it. Someone had a question.
No, that was it. Sun up to sundown. That you answered.
Yeah, the fast on Monday is sunrise to sunset. And don't start singing yet.
Yes, because I was wondering about my synagogue, how they were going to have an ice cream social Monday night if they were supposed to be fasting.
No, Monday night, that's fine.
I know. Okay.
No, the fast would end at sundown on Monday no matter what. The question is, did it start Sunday night? Because again, think about Yom Kippur.
Right.
Yom Kippur starts the night, quote unquote, the night before.
Right.
Okay, I see some really confused looks. In Judaism, the day starts at night. Now, if that is not the most Jewish thing you've ever heard, that's the way it is, right? The day starts at night. Right. We're all laughing, right? But that's what it is. So when you have to fast the full day, like Yom Kippur, it starts at the night. Starts at sundown.
Oh, sundown.
That's when night begins.
Okay.
Sunset. Now the new day is beginning. So you have 12 hours of night, 12 hours of day. That constitutes your 24 hours. Most fasts are not the full 24 hours. It's just from sunrise to sunset. Mm-hmm. That's what this fast, the fast of Esther, Monday, would be. Okay? Great. Hey, you want to learn a little something? Okay, great.
We just did.
Okay, thanks for coming. Hey, we'll see you guys next week. Okay, we're in the next room. Our room in our house, because our house is a fancy schmancy house. Because only the best for my group. We have beautiful homes. We have beautiful rooms. We have so much. We even have a wine cellar. That's what we're going tonight. We're going down to the wine cellar. Because, as we know, Purim is upon us. And one of the most known customs, one of the most well-known activities of Purim is the ability to partake and imbibe of alcoholic beverages. Now, I will be very careful. That's the only time I'm going to say that. There is no mitzvah at all to drink liquor. It's not any alcoholic beverage. That is not the mitzvah. That's not the custom. Not beer, not liquor. None of that. It's specifically wine. Sorry, Alan. It's wine. Ben, let's try to understand what is the significance of wine in Judaism and how this, in particular, when we talk about Purim, let's see if we can tie it all together. Okay. We'll start. Okay, I got you, Roz. Glad to have you, though. Okay, so before we get started, though, I want you to have really appreciation for what we're going to talk about. So I want to tell you about the story of a leader of a house of worship. He was giving one of his fiery sermons, and he said, "If I had all the beer in the world, I would take it and throw it in the river. And if I had all the wine in the world, I would take it and throw it in the river. If I had all the whiskey in the world, I would take it and throw it in the river." And he sat down. The choir leader, knowing that that was his cue, he stood up and he said with a little smirk, "All rise, please, for the singing of hymn number 258. We shall gather at the river." Okay, fine. All right. I'll stick to my day job. Okay, but what's the deal with wine in general, and what can we learn from it as it pertains to Purim? Okay, so let's start with this. I want to read you a passage from the Talmud. We're going to be Talmudic scholars tonight. The Talmud is discussing the theme about that words of Torah, what they can be compared to. And there's different comparisons that are given. This one where the Talmud is talking now is talking about why words of Torah are compared to three liquids: water, wine, and milk. Talmud gets off in a discussion. What is the comparisons? Why are the words compared, the words of Torah compared to these three liquids? Listen to what it says. This is to teach you. I'm reading you straight from the Talmud. "Just as these three liquids are preserved only in the most inferior of vessels," meaning earthenware vessels, "so too the words of Torah are retained only by someone who is humble." You hear that? Not a fancy schmancy golden goblet. Not a big fancy silver something. No. Humble. It's an earthenware vessel. Listen to the story. As the Caesar's daughter once said to Rabbi Yehoshua, "Whoa, whoa, whoa," she said, "glorious wisdom," meaning Torah, "in an ugly vessel like you?" Now, it's not something I would say to my good friend, let alone somebody I don't know. But she decided she was going to share her thoughts about the beauty or lack thereof of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hanania. She said, "How can it be a scholar like you to retain Torah in such an ugly vessel? You're an ugly person. How can this be?" He responded to her and said, "Doesn't your father put his wine in earthenware vessels, which are ugly?" She said to him, "But what else should we put the wine in? Everybody uses earthenware vessels." He said to her, "You, who are nobility, should put your wine in vessels of gold and silver." She went, reported the suggestion to her father. He put the wine in vessels of gold and silver, and it became sour. Of course it went rancid. When his servants came to tell him that the wine had spoiled, he says to his daughter, "Who told you to do this?" She answered him, "Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hanania." And Caesar asked him point blank, "Why did you tell my daughter to do this?" He responded, "As she spoke to me, so I replied to her." I have a sense of that's the end of the piece of Talmud. What this last line mean is that she found it surprising that wisdom can be contained in an ugly person. So I gave her a reply facetiously demonstrating that just as wine is preserved in an ugly earthenware vessel, so too Torah is better preserved in me in as much as I am not handsome. That's the response. It's a fascinating piece. It's not over. One more line. Ah, but there are beautiful people who are learned, asks the Talmud. There are plenty of nice looking people who might have Torah knowledge. We may know one or two. How can you say that it's only in those that are inferior looks? Rabbi Yeshua answered, if these handsome scholars would be less handsome or less focused on it, they'd be even more learned. That's the end of the piece. It's a nice story if you want to read folk tales. If you want to just get a nice, good story, you want to read it to your kid or grandkid. Oh, I want to read you a bedtime story. But that's not what the Talmud is all about. The Talmud is there to teach us important lessons. There must be something much more to this, or at least some deeper meaning. Some of the basic questions let's ask ourselves. Number one, why is the example being used about wine? Because that's the theme of the night, we have to ask. What is so significant that she is the daughter of a Roman Caesar? Why is that significant? Okay. So here's what we want to go with this. You've heard me speak about this concept in that the physical world and the spiritual world are tethered together. What I mean by that, in Judaism, we believe very strongly that since we are comprised of both a physical body and have a spiritual soul, they have to work together. We are not to deny nor give complete control to either one of them. There needs to be a harmony, a synthesis of both body and soul, physical and spiritual. And that's really the path in life, of finding that balance of where, yes, I do need to eat, but I need to eat in a way that is conducive for my spiritual well-being in addition to my physical well-being. Hence the idea of eating only certain kinds of foods that are beneficial to the soul, kosher. Being careful to bless and acknowledge that the food came from God so that your soul gets benefit. When we've talked about this. But for tonight, I want to put a different spin on that. And that is, while the two definitely are linked, there is an inverse relationship between the physical and spiritual world. Let's start with this. What's the story I want to quote? Come on. Where are we going? Garden of Eden. Okay, Garden of Eden. I should really write a book, all the insights on the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve do something they're not supposed to. They eat from that tree. God is not happy. This is the short version. God is not happy. Fine. Throws them out. Everybody gets a punishment. Okay? What's the big punishment for humanity at large? It's called, we became mortal. Death has been decreed upon us. Right? We remember that story, right? Okay. One of the things that's not spoken about as much as it should be is that death is not a one-time event. What I mean to say, I'm not going crazy on you here. What I mean to say is that death is a prototype that is not prototype. Death is the culmination of a process. We in the physical world know that everything, as time goes on, gets decayed, begins to spoil and break down. Things don't get better in the physical world. The physical world, the more it's around, the less effective it is. Things wear out. Clothing, if you wear it enough times, you will get a hole in your elbow of your shirt, right? I should really be like those who create the jeans with holes and rips in them. They make a heck of a lot more money with the holes and the rips. I should really sell my shirts. I really should. They'd go for a lot. But things wear down in the physical realm. Every year we get older, we got a kink in the neck and a thing in the knee. And that is what we call life. We get older. The that is a corollary of the punishment called death, and that everything decays. Bananas. I love talking about bananas. Why? Because the shelf life of bananas is 18 seconds. Then it begins to spoil. Fact. That's what it is. Fruit. We bought a great thing at I don't know, BJ's or Costco or Sam's Club. I don't know. A box of 6 mangoes on Friday. Today is only Wednesday, for goodness sakes. One of them's already getting yucky. God, I didn't have a chance to eat it yet. Well, that is the nature of the physical world. Things, as they get older, get worse, not better. Okay? In the spiritual world, it's just the opposite. It is really just the opposite. The more a person is able to tap into that soul, that spiritual side, it actually improves. There is a world of difference when you engage the mind, which is, again, it's a physical brain, but thoughts and ideas and computations and considerations, right? If you stay sharp, even as you get older, actually, wisdom improves with age, doesn't get worse. Now, yes, unfortunately, there are conditions, diseases that don't allow us to have that, and where, unfortunately, the brain also suffers. But you find many, many, many people, scholars and non-scholars alike, who are able to remain sharp as a tack in their older years. Because spiritual things don't get worse with time, they improve. So there's an inverse relationship between the physical and the spiritual. This is the question that this daughter of the Caesar is grappling with. She sees this man who is a Torah scholar, and she doesn't understand. How can it be? You're an ugly person. In the physical realm, you're at the low end of things. You're a zero. You're a one at best. How can there be such wisdom contained within it? It doesn't seem to match my perspective of the earthly life we live. Beautiful things. That is where beauty relies. That's where all goodness is. An earthenware, it seems to be contradictory. What does Rabbi Yeshua answer her? Where does your father store wine? Didn't ask where he stored oil, where he stores grain. Where does he store wine? Because wine, as we all know, is the exception to the rule. All things in the physical realm get worse over time, but not wine. Wine improves with age, right? A good bottle of wine that's 3 years old is a fraction of the cost of a good wine that's 10 years old. Why? Why is that? Why is wine the exception to the whole rule? Every other thing. Can you think of anything else in the physical realm that doesn't get worse over time?
You.
I'm somewhere between the physical and the spiritual. I'm like half and half. Yeah, I also break down. It's the way it is. Wine is the exception. Okay? If you think about it, it really goes even further. I told you that this is which government is she representing? The Talmud said that she was the daughter of a
Roman
Caesar. Tell me a little bit about Roman culture.
They're very glitzy.
Yes. Their focus, very much like the Greeks, they took it to the next level, was all about aesthetics. It's all about the physical beauty. Yeah. This Roman had the philosophy about the physical world, and it doesn't jive with her philosophy. How could something so beautiful of wisdom be contained in a physically inferior product. Rabbi Yeshua's answer is because you have the wrong perspective. You need to focus in on how wine works. Wine is unique because wine, well, I don't want to give it all away. Let's do it this way. He teaches her that in the world of spiritual matters, the container needs to be simpler for the contents to be pure. Please tell me, who was the most humble individual that walked the face of the earth? Moses. Thank you. Moses. Tell me, who was the one who was chosen to be the one to give us and teach us God's Torah? Highest level of wisdom a human being ever attained?
Moses.
Yeah. Because that's the formula. It's not the one who is the most beautiful and arrogant and shows off in that way. No. It's the one who's most humble, considers themselves that whatever I have is a gift from God. It's not me. That's the person who is most fitting to be the Torah scholar, the one to be the one to give it over, because that's what matters most in the spiritual realm. So the inner spiritual values are inversely related to the outer physical ones. As we said, everything in the physical world gets worse over time. In the spiritual world, things improve with time. Wisdom increases with age if it's nurtured properly. As I said, the exception is wine. And as I said, it's not an accident that Rabbi Yeshua's lesson to this princess, to this Caesar's daughter, was specifically with wine. What you hear, what you see, is that the physical creation is providing a window. This one item called wine provides us a window into understanding that inner hidden spiritual world. You know what? I'll give you an example. I want to be clear about this. People ask, so Rabbi, tell me about God. Teach me about God. So I'm only able to go so far, to the best of my knowledge, because I am a physical human being, and as great as I may be, as great as any human being that has ever walked this planet, you cannot fully comprehend God, because God is infinite. We are finite. We are limited. The best we can do is to describe what we know about God, but I can't get to the essence of God. Because there's nothing in my lexicon. There's nothing I can say. You know what God is like? God is like this. Well, I don't have a this to say this is what God is like. There's nothing I can compare God to. If someone says to me, can you describe for me a tangerine? I said, well, that's an interesting fruit. It has characteristics like an orange. You know what an orange is, right? Oh, yeah, I know what an orange is. I can use terminology to help expand their knowledge base because you have a working definition of an orange. Okay, so I can build on that. Here's what it's like and here why it's not like it. Perfect. But when it comes to all of these concepts, spiritual concepts, what language can I use to explain it? Everything in the physical world is an inverse relationship to it. How do I use the words? Oh, you want to know how incredibly infinite God's wisdom is? Oh, it's like I got nothing. Except one thing. Wine. Wine is, not that that's the explanation of God. No. I'm back to our story. Wine is the example I can use to show that there is something in the physical world that is very much a good example of what goes on in the spiritual world. Wine is the great example for it because it is the physical manifestation of spiritual rules. Did I say that again? Wine is the physical representation or manifestation of what goes on in the spiritual realm. That's what it is. It goes against everything in the laws of physics. It gets better with age. Nothing else does that. Why does God give us this one item so that we can have an inkling of what that spiritual world is like. It's a window into that world. It's not for no reason that the numerical value of the word yayin, wine, is 70. Yud is 10, second yud is another 10, and nun is 50. So 10, 10, and 50, even at this late hour, that's 70. Okay? It's the same numerical value as sod. Sod means secret. Samach is 60, vav is 6, dalet is 4. 60, 6, and 4 is 70. Wine is the answer to the secret of the spiritual world. I'm able to appreciate these concepts of the spiritual world because I have wine as an example. The Talmud says, Nichnas Yayin, when wine enters, Yatsa Sod, out come secrets. The simple understanding is loose lips sink ships. That's the simple understanding, that when a person partakes of wine, they let things slip across their mouth and out come secrets. I'll tell you a great story. I'll tell you a great story. Oh my gosh. It just popped into my head. I had forgotten about it. I think it was the first, maybe second year we were married. We went for the Purim meal to one of my teachers, one of my rabbeim in Ner Israel. And there was we weren't the only ones. There were a whole bunch of young couples that were invited. So one of our friends, one of these other couples, so the boy my age, imbibed quite a bit, and he's a musician, so he's up there on the chair and he's playing his guitar and he's really in the Purim spirit. And his wife was in nursing school, and she asked my wife if we wouldn't mind that when we left the meal, we live not far from them, to please drop him off at home. She'll already be back from her class. Okay, fine. Fine. The night goes great. Fine. We get him in the car. I'm only slightly tipsy. He's way past that point. We get him in the car. My wife, of course, is driving. We get to his apartment, and I'm getting ready to go out to help him out of the car because he needs help. And out comes his wife. Okay? His wife was home from class already. She comes out, and she goes, oh, come with me, come. So she reaches down to start helping him get out. And he looks up at her with, you know, with blurry eyes and says, oh, you can't help me. The doctor said you can't lift things more than 40 pounds. You're pregnant. OMG. They hadn't told anybody yet. They hadn't told their parents. She just found out. And meanwhile, he's spilling his guts to just friends who happened to be in the car with her. Yeah. In goes wine, out comes secrets. Oh man, she was like mortified. Like, just let the earth open up and swallow me now. Thank God she said it was you guys and nobody else. So that's the simple understanding of that Talmud. In comes wine, out comes secrets. But obviously there's so much more to that, because enter wine, out come the secrets of the spiritual world. You get an insight that under non-imbibed, you know, evening, where you're not under the influence, you don't have that impact of wine. You can't see it because we're so in the physical world. When you have wine, not just seeing it, but partaking of it, it gives you a certain high. And I'm using the word purposely. It is a certain... It's a high. You get elevated, you know. Lord, get me high, get me high. Right. And you start singing like that. No, I haven't started. What is so sing? What do you mean you get high? Yeah. You know what? We are down here on earth. If you want to get another perspective of life, you know what you should do? Get a bird's eye view of it. Go up a little higher and look down from a totally different vantage point. You see things that you'll never notice. It's like seeing the trees and not seeing the forest. When you partake of wine, you get a little bit off your game. You get a totally different perspective. But wine is the example that gives us the ability to see it from a different way. I'll give you, again, another example. Okay. When do we use wine for various ceremonies in Judaism? When do we use it? On what occasions? Name me an occasion.
Shabbos.
Okay. For Kiddush.
Right.
Kiddush on Shabbos. What else?
Circumcision.
At a bris. That's correct. That's circumcision. When else?
Weddings.
At a wedding. Correct. One more that I can think of.
Havdalah.
Oh, at a Passover?
We'll get to Havdalah. And excellent. We'll do Havdalah. That's my fifth. And yes, Robin, correct. At the Pesach Seder. At the Passover Seder. Those are the times that we are required to take wine in celebration of it. So I get it. Because all four, we'll get to Havdalah in a minute, but all of the other four are all occasions of where I'm connecting a physical with a spiritual take. Let's go through them. A wedding, that's the most obvious, where you have two people, two physical entities that are joining together in a relationship of holiness. Not just happens to be two people living together. The word in Hebrew for the marriage is called kiddushin, from the word kadosh, because this is an elevation of sanctity, using the physical. Yes, two physical beings can elevate through their relationship and bring God's presence closer. We do it at a bris, at circumcision. That's also pretty straightforward. We're taking the most physical organ, right? It's the organ that represents real physicality. It's the use for reproduction. And we are sanctifying it and saying, I am doing this as a mitzvah that God has commanded me to do. It brings the person into the ranks of the Jewish people. That's elevation. But there's a connection, physical with spiritual. Kiddush Friday night. If you haven't listened to my class in weeks, then shame on you, because that's all we spoke about, this whole concept of where the physical domain of the week is elevated now that you have Shabbos, the 6 days of the week, because you have a purpose called Shabbos. Or Shabbos sets the tone for the next week, but it's a combination of the physical and the spiritual. Pesach at the Seder, slavery transitioning to freedom. How did we get our freedom? We went from physical labor, physical slavery, and then we got a Torah at the end of the Exodus. It's always, every time we have the combining of physical and spiritual, we celebrate it with wine. Because that's the message. But wait, Susan wants to know, that doesn't seem to fit with Havdalah. Havdalah, the after Shabbos ceremony, you would think would be just the opposite. It's a letdown. The holiness of Shabbos is leaving. Why would I celebrate with wine? Ah, but you attended a class just a couple of Wednesdays ago. We talked about this, and that's exactly the point. Because the week's beginning marks the new opportunity to go build and elevate ourselves towards the next higher Shabbos. So yeah, even Havdalah is that merging of the physical and the spiritual. You with me? So wine is such a great prototype. It's the only thing in our physical realm that gives us that little window into really the spiritual world as it functions. But there's another piece to this. It really symbolizes the completed and perfected human life. How does wine begin? What's the beginning process?
Grapes.
It starts as a grape. It's a nice fruit. It's a very pleasant fruit when it's in season, right? And it's not smushed. You have this product. It's somewhat of an inferior product because it even goes sour to some degree. And what happens? It goes through a fermentation process. What is the fermentation process? It's struggle, challenges, not the easy. You don't just let it sit out. It really goes through a decomposition somewhat. It gets beat down until you're able to produce a juice. And then what? You let it ferment even further. And then it becomes a superior product. You think grapes are expensive? Wine is even more expensive. Why? Because it went from an inferior product, went through a hard struggle process, and turns into a superior product in the end. Is that not a beautiful perspective of what life we're supposed to be? We start as an inferior product, a selfish little infant. You have no idea what's going to be. I found this in a book once. I try to keep it in mind. We have things backwards sometimes. Everybody celebrates the birth of a child. And we cry when a person passes away. Truth of the matter is, if we really thought about it, it should be the other way around. I have no idea what this young baby is going to be like. He may be the next axe murderer. We have no idea how it's going to play out. What are we celebrating? When a person passes away, we know what they accomplished. We can be proud. We can say, wow, that person was amazing. What great gift they left to the world. Okay, I'm oversimplifying it, but it's a good point. We should somewhat celebrate the end of a life.
That's why we remember the date of their death.
When?
What'd you say? I said that's why we remember the date of their death. People
right, yard site, correct. We do.
Yard site as opposed to the birth, because we don't know what a person's going to be, but we certainly correct. Know what they were.
Correct. It's interesting. There's only one figure, only one person in the entire Torah who the Torah identifies and focuses on their birthday. Not that we know what day it was, but the fact that it was being celebrated, his birthday. It's only one person in the entire Torah. Who is it, Robin?
Is it Moses? Because his birthday is the same day as his death?
Nope.
But his birthday is the same day as his death.
That is true. Right. It is. His birthday and his death day.
And that was yesterday.
The Torah does not. It was just yesterday, right?
Yes, I know.
Correct. But it does not say in the Torah what his birthday was. And it doesn't even make reference that his birthday, that there was a celebration.
Okay. Adam, because we know what day.
No, that's not fair, yes. But it doesn't say his birthday, that there's a celebration. You'd be shocked when I tell you who it is. He's not even Jewish.
Yisrael?
Nope.
Pharaoh?
Who Jesus? Said that?
Pharaoh?
Pharaoh. That Pharaoh? Is correct.
Why?
Pharaoh in the story, yes, with Joseph and his brothers. When the wine steward and the baker, and they had their dreams and Joseph interpreted, why were they in jail? Because each one made a big boo-boo. The wine steward, there was a fly in the wine, and the baker, there was a pebble in the bread, right? So they were thrown in jail. Joseph interprets their dreams, and the wine steward is returned back to his post. When did that happen? When did that happen? What all of a sudden did they get their jobs back?
Pharaoh's birthday?
Yep. Exactly right. I'll read it to you. I'm telling you, I can't make this stuff up. It's all here. Joseph interprets the dream. The chamber of the baker saw that he had interpreted well. So he said to Joseph, I too in my dream behold, three wicker baskets were on my head. And in the uppermost basket were all kinds of Pharaoh's food, baker's handiwork, and the birds were eating them from the basket above my head. Joseph responded and said, this is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you and hang you on a tree. Birds will eat your flesh from you. Next verse. And it was on the third day, Pharaoh's birthday. Mm. Here it is, black on white. Muriel, you're looking at me like I'm making stuff up. You want to hear? Check it out. Chapter 40, verse 20. 40:20. Look it up. Genesis 40:20. I'm telling you, I can't make this stuff up. It was Pharaoh's birthday. He made a feast for all of his servants, and he counted the chamberlain of the cupbearer and the chamberlain of the bakers among his servants. He restored the chamberlain of cupbearers to his cupbearing, placed the cup in Pharaoh's palm, but he hanged the chamberlain of the bakers just as Joseph had interpreted them, etc., etc. It's the only time in the Torah somebody's birthday is mentioned and celebrated. There you go. I'm telling you, you guys will absolutely rock if you play Jewish Trivial Pursuit. You guys know it all. Okay, but back to wine, okay? Wine is that great symbol of about a person. that starts as an inferior being through toil and struggle, working on themselves, character development, doing better in their relationship with people, between man to man, and their relationship between man and God. By the time you have a superior product, that's called a man. That's called a person. That's one. But let's go one more step. Where are we at here? Okay, great. Let's take it. Another point. Okay. Wine, as I started to allude to earlier, gives you an elevated existence. Again, I want to be very careful. I want to make it very clear. I'm not suggesting that a person should go ahead and get stone drunk on Purim. That is not my philosophy. That is not what I'm saying. Should a person have a little wine if they can? If they can. Obviously, everyone has their medical issue or whatever they're dealing with. That's a different story. But a regular person that doesn't have those kinds of challenges, they should partake of at least some wine. Small, take a little bit. That's fine. Even those who are big drinkers, do it in moderation. I'm sure I've shared this in the past. There was a beautiful poster hanging in the yeshiva when I was younger. And it showed really just a real close-up of a gurney. A gurney, you guys know what a gurney is, right? They, you know, for the hospital or the ambulance. And big, bold letters. It said, "This Purim, don't get carried away." Brilliant. Brilliant. It had a very, very strong message. I'm of that philosophy. You're going to drink in moderation. Take a little edge off, a little bit looser. I'm okay with that. If any of you have ever been to my Purim meal, you know I do partake. I do get a little giddy. But what comes out of my mouth? It's Torah. I love to share insights about Purim and Torah. That's what, I'm usually generally a shy guy. I don't like to share so much. On Purim, I let it all out. I just share more and more and more. Okay? So there is a certain element of elevated understanding. In Hebrew, it's called da'at. Knowledge, understanding. So someone asked the question, why should it be that on Purim, why should it be in general that I have to imbibe with wine to have that elevated status? Listen to a parable that explains how this happens through wine. Listen to a story. It's set back in the 1800s. You have two boys. They were inseparable in their early years. They played together, learned together. They did just about everything they could together. They were so close. Obviously, as time went on, they became of marriageable age. And their parents had made arrangements for the shidduchim, for a shidduch for them. Not long after they were married, each to a woman who lived in a town that was far away from the one that they had grown up in. At the time, as we know, in the 1800s, travel was quite slow, expensive. Mail delivery was pretty much what it is now. And it didn't take long. That was a good dig, right?
It was.
Yeah. It didn't take long for each of the boys to forget about his friend, as he worked on building his own relationship with his wife and family. Years and years passed, and both happened on occasion to travel. As God would arrange it, divine providence would have it, they both passed through the Vienna train station at the same time, though they were headed in opposite directions. As they made their way to their trains, they passed each other on the platform. At first, they didn't recognize each other. Black, scraggly beards had given way to full gray beards over the years. They were full-grown men now, and each looked it. But as they nonchalantly passed each other, they froze in their tracks. Somehow, something looked familiar. Memories quickly returned, and slowly, each of them turned around, found themselves facing each other. Shlomi, is that you? Maishi, is that you? I can't think of more Jewish names than that, right? Suddenly, in the middle of a crowded Vienna train station, two grown men dropped their valises, embraced each other, attracting lots of attention. They remained in their embraces as they walked, as if letting go would mean that they would be separated for another 25 to 30 years. They made their way over to a bench. Maishi, Shlomi jumped in. I've heard so much about you. I've heard you've made a real name for yourself in Torah knowledge. How's your wife, your family? What are you up to these days? Maishi said, you, I hear that you're a great businessman. I always knew you'd be one someday. All of a sudden, a train blew its whistle. And then another train blew its whistle. It was the first warning that the time had come to board the trains. Shlomi and Moshe looked at each other and they asked, which way are you going? Oh, I'm going west. How about you? Oh, I'm going east. No, it can't be. How can it be 25 years of separation can come down to a few minutes of a reunion? Wait, Shlomi says, I have a great idea. I have wine in my bag and a glass. Why don't you take a glass of wine and bring it to the conductor of your train? I'll do the same to the conductor of my train. We'll get them drunk. Then no one will go anywhere for at least an hour. We'll have a chance to catch up on everything that's happened since we last left Yeshiva. Beautiful parable. This is what it's like on Friday. This parable comes from Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner was one of the great sages, lived in New York. Brilliant mind. I have two of his works. He wrote extensively. I only have two of them. And I am brutally honest. I don't understand 90% of what he's talking about. I really do not. It is hard Hebrew. It's a brilliant mind. Rav Huttner said, the soul of each person comes down to the body prior to our birth, pure, unadulterated. It comes to perform a mission. To elevate the body, elevate the person, make him holy. However, by virtue of its nature, the body has other plans. And over the course of the year, it schleps the soul through all the mud of everyday mundane life. Oh, if only the body, the conductor, would take a break, would rest for a moment. Perhaps then the soul could go back to being the soul once again. And in the process, even elevate the body. But day after day, the whistle blows and the body's on the move again, schlepping the soul around through the world. On Purim, once a year, writes Rav Huttner, we get the conductor drunk. We get the conductor to slow down. Let the conductor, the body, imbibe in the wine. So for at least one afternoon, we're not going anywhere. We're not running around. We're not just focused on our physical. We go ahead and the soul finally has a chance to catch up on soul business and relate to other souls as a soul, not just a body. What a great parable. Again, I'm not giving carte blanche for people to just go off the handle and drink. That's not. But there is a strong basis to understand where this custom comes from. And what it is on a deeper level we're trying to achieve. It's not that, as I thought as a younger child, that this is just Judaism's way of saying, get one day to let it all out. That is not true. Not true. That's what I thought when I was younger and I was wrong. It is so much more, so much deeper, that it gives us an opportunity to almost take a time out, refresh, take the edge off the physicality, give it some pleasure, and now soak it up. Soak up another layer of understanding about Judaism that maybe you never had before. I hope it'll go out shortly. We're sending out on various social media. I don't even know this stuff, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. I don't know from this. But I, together with some of the other head staff, we put together a few nice insights about Purim. I don't want to tell you what I said because I hope you'll see it. We'll send it out. You'll take a look at it. Listen to it. Talk about it over Purim. Whether you're at someone else's meal or you're having your own meal, talk about it. Utilize the day of Purim for what it's really meant to be. I love to say this over. The name of the book that we read is called Megillat Esther, right? The scroll of Esther, Megillah of Esther. But the words themselves have translation. The word Megillah does not mean a scroll. That's not really the translation. Let's work backwards. What does the word Esther mean? Why was she called Esther?
From Nestar, hidden.
Means hidden. That's correct. The Torah actually uses that expression. V'anochi Haster aster panai. God says, if you're not going to follow me, you're not going to listen to my Torah, then I'm going to hide my face from you. I will become more hidden, more difficult to find. The word Esther means to be hidden. But now is the kicker. What does the word Megillah mean? It means to reveal. Ah, Megillat Esther means to reveal that which is hidden. If you ever look at the story of the book of Esther, that's exactly the message. On the surface, it looks like a cool story of how many coincidences take place and happens to be, and that happens to be, and he suggested, and it happened to be. You say the word happened to be at least 40 times in that story. Unless you take our perspective of it, and that is, there's not one happens to be. This is all part of a master plan. God is hidden. The name of God is not explicit anywhere in those 10 chapters of the Megillah. There are references. There are allusions to it. The point of reading the book of Esther is Megillat Esther. Reveal that which is hidden. And you want to know what you use to help you afterwards? In the same mindset of trying to reveal that hiddenness of spirituality, it's called wine. Wine is the hidden middle of your grape. It's the center. It's the juice that you don't see until you squeeze it out. Put effort, beat it out, get it, toil, work at it. You get some really delicious wine out of it. And you get some beautiful, delicious insights about life, about our relationships, about Torah. That's why wine plays such a pivotal role in the story of Purim. I'll drink to that. Yes, Robin.
Is that why I think I've heard that, like, when you're supposed to wear costumes and then get so drunk that you don't recognize anybody?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Well, it says you drink to the point of where you can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed be Mordechai. So on a simple level, that means you're stone drunk. But that can't be what it means. It means the same way that I look at things in my life and I say, oh, that's a wonderful event. God willing, marrying off a child. That's a beautiful thing. And then you see a tragedy. A young boy is killed driving, you know, when he's riding his bicycle here in Baltimore. We just had this last week. Young 22-year-old kid was hit by a car and he died. Right? Oh, it's a tragedy. It really is. But we see things as good and bad. The truth of the matter is, from a Torah perspective, there's neither good, there's neither bad. It's all part of God's plan. How? I don't know. When it says that you partake of wine to the point you can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai, because it all stems from the same source. This is God's plan. That's what it means. Well, it doesn't mean you're stone drunk that you can't tell who anyone is anymore.
Right, but also like getting into your message of hidden. People are hidden.
Good. That's where the costumes come up, right? That's one of the reasons why we dress up in costume. Because it's that same idea of hiddenness. Delve deeper. We all know this in our life. We don't buy a car based on the outside. You look up the specs. What kind of engine is it? You know, if it's a used car, you want to know. Give me the Carfax report. You want to know the nuts and bolts. You want to know how it really, the essence of it. Dig deeper. Don't go for the superficial because it's got, you know, chrome hubcaps, if that's your thing. That's how we view life. We don't live in a superficially. That's not who we are. This is no different. Delve deeper. The story of Purim reminds us, look behind the veil. Look behind the mask. There's a God. There's a world of order, of values, all this stuff. You hear me talk about this all the time. But that's what the message of Purim is. You're right, Robin. All of these messages, the name of the book, the fact that we use wine, that it's hidden within, the fact that we consistently remind ourselves, give something to someone else. Don't stay hidden in your own home. Go out, show somebody, reveal that which is hidden. What else?
Drink more wine.
Yes, L'chaim. L'chaim. Yes. You know what? It's interesting. L'chaim that we wish. You know, everybody knows L'chaim, right?
Life.
You pick up a cup of wine life. And you wish L'chaim.
To life.
What does it mean?
To life.
To life. Yeah, but it's in the plural. There's no singular word for it. Hmm. How about that? Why?
Like the physical and the spiritual life?
Right.
Maybe. Maybe. I think in a very practical way. Come on.
We live? I don't know.
Yes. That would just be l'chai. L'chai means life in the singular. But we don't say that. We say l'chayim.
Like your individual and your community life of all the
Jews. Thank you. Exactly.
Nation.
That is all part of the people. We are together with others. All the mitzvos of Purim are communal in the sense of we don't do it by ourselves. Mm-hmm. I don't live by myself. I, technically speaking, I can fulfill the mitzvah of hearing the Megillah in the privacy of my home. I know how to read it. I have a Torah. I have a scroll. I can theoretically fulfill the mitzvah, but I try not to. I try to go to shul. I go to synagogue. Why? Because I want to be with people. It's all about the unity of us. The same thing is true. The meal, I could theoretically have it by myself, but I choose not to. I invite others. I give packages to others. I give extra charity to the needy. It's all about the bringing it all together with the rest of the Jewish people. Hence, when you pick up a cup of wine, you don't say, it's all for me, to the king. No, we don't do the king. We say to us, l'chaim, all of us. Fred.
When you give the, I always pronounce it wrong, monash, when you give those out, you're not supposed to give it directly. I understand. If I wanted to give something to you, I would give it to, well, Sharon might see you every day. I might give it to Sharon. This is for Rabbi T. Why do you do that instead of giving it direct?
Because the phrase that you're having trouble with is called Mishloach Manot.
Yes.
Or it gets corrupted to Shalach Manas.
That's what I hear.
Right. That's a but that's a corruption. There's no such word as Shalach Manas. It's Mishloach Manos is the real word. The same thing. What's the third meal of Shabbos called?
Seudah Shlishit.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Susan. That's the right way. But how does everybody say it? Shalashudis. Shalashudis. It's not even English. It's not even. There's no such words. Shalashudis. It's like one big word. Spelled S-H-A-L-O-S-H-S-E-U-D-O-S. Shaloshodis. What is it? I don't know. It's a corruption of the word shalosh seudot. Three meals. That's really what it is. Or if you want to be more technical, Susan's right. It is the third meal, seuda shlishi. So mishloach manos means sent packages. Doesn't mean, yeah. So while, yes, the objective is for me to give something to you, the phraseology that's used is that it is sent, meaning it's through a messenger, through a third person, right?
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Why? I think the same idea. The more people you get involved in this, the more we are a cohesive unit.
Hmm.
If I give it to you, only two people benefited here, you and me. If I get Sharon to deliver it, so then it's you, me, and Sharon.
I'm
going to
be busy.
Yeah.
You're going to be busy back and forth.
That's what you get for commuting.
That's it. What else? We good?
By the way, I did read an article years and years ago in some Jewish magazine about young rabbis overdoing it on Purim, and they were trying to convince them the idea was not to get drunk because people were actually having alcohol. They were having issues with yeah. alcohol, and this was to try to calm it down. But
I wrote it.
Yeah, probably. But the thing I always used to hear was, you should drink so much that you can't tell the difference between, you know, Haman and Mordecai.
Right.
And that's all I ever heard of a description.
Well, you can't say it anymore.
No, you brought it back to earth.
I throw it out there. If anybody wants, I'm being this seriously, if anybody wants, and you don't, no pressure, but you are all welcome to come join me at the Purim meal this Tuesday this Tuesday afternoon. You're more than welcome to come into Baltimore. Yeah, go ahead, Chuck. Arlene wants to come, right? Get on a plane. Tuesday, you are more than welcome to pop in. You're welcome to join us. My wife makes a crazy good meal. And there'll probably be something to imbibe. So no pressure, but you are more than welcome to come join. If
what
I don't
time is
see,
it?
Thank you. No, many of you probably have your
what
own.
What time is it?
I'll probably start at 4:30, 5, something like that. It'll be later in the afternoon. Like I said, I want to make sure that I get started before sunset, and sunset's about 6. So, I want to make sure that it kicks in just in time.
But I was surprised about the wine, because I remember that was the one time I would see schnapps always being offered.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think people lose sight of what this is all about. To the best of my knowledge, I could be wrong, but I don't think there's any mitzvah of schnapps using liquor. That's just people like that better. Okay, but there's a mitzvah specifically associated with wine. And now when you see that, when you see someone, tell them they can listen to the class. There is something unique about wine. It represents concepts that are not found in liquor or beer for that matter. So,
well, I don't like either. I like wine. I like the taste of wine, not whiskey. Not
beer. All right. So. If I don't see you before then, have a fabulous, fabulous Shabbos, a wonderful Purim. I hope that the effects of it will be worn off by next Wednesday night. Should be good to go. But either way, we will continue on our journey. All right. Have a
Thank
great
you,
rest
Rabbi
of the week.
T.
Yes, ma'am. My pleasure.
Thank you.